Hello, Entitled listeners. We are hard at work on season 3. No spoilers, but it's going to be a big one. In the meantime, Tom and I realize there are so many conversations around rights we want to have, but that don't fit perfectly into our seasons. So, while we work on season 3, we're going to be putting out monthly episodes that are more straightforward interviews and discussions on various rights topics, like the idea of personalized law, housing rights, abortion, or in the case of this episode, animal rights. For our first interview-style episode, we picked a superstar guest who's been on the podcast before, our colleague Martha Nussbaum. She is a philosopher and a professor of law at the University of Chicago and a prolific writer. Her latest book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility, dives into the ways we fail to include animals in our concept of rights and why we should. We hope you enjoy the show, and we'll see you next month for another episode and more updates on season 3. For now, here's Martha Nussbaum. Thanks for listening.
I'm Professor Martha C. Nussbaum, Professor of Law and Philosophy at the University of Chicago.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Martha. And of course, we had you on our very first episode, so our listeners are familiar with your work. But we're here today to talk with you about your brand new book, your latest book, which is extending a lot of your thinking on rights and justice to a new realm, which is, of course, the realm of animals. Why would we think that animals have rights? Rights is a human category. You know, isn't that a category error to think about animals in this regard?
Well, rights are claims backed by arguments of justice. And so the question whether somebody or something has rights depends on the question of whether there is injustice. And I say that intuitively, injustice involves a sentient being who is trying to do something, who is striving, and then who is blocked, thwarted, by action that's either malicious or negligent. Now, of course, that can happen to animals too, just as much as to humans. Each person has a right to be where he or she is. That entails that you have a right to use the things that help you to protect your position, keep you alive, and so forth. Both humans and animals find ourselves thrown into a rather hostile world, and we have to make use of what is at hand to live and thrive. And so why should we say that humans have rights and animals don't? So that's basically the view that I developed.
Yes, there's so much to unpack, actually, in what you said. And maybe I'll just start with the first thing, which is sentience. So, what is that concept? What do you mean when you mean sentience? And why would we limit, I suppose, a theory of justice just to sentient beings?
Well, here's where I do agree with the utilitarians. I disagree with them in many respects. But I think they were quite right to say that the capacity to feel pain and to suffer is absolutely fundamental. Pain is the thing that scientists can demonstrate experimentally much more easily than other forms of sentience. So that takes precedence in the experiments, but sentience is far more than that. It's having your own point of view on the world. I think most people are pretty clear that most mammals have sentience by now. The controversial cases have been birds, but by now I think every scientist agrees that birds are sentient. The most controversial recently has been fish. And there are lots of experiments, which I describe in detail in the book, where it turns out that the ability to feel pain is fundamental in explaining the behavior of fish in certain experimental situations. I would say that 95% of scientists agree that fish feel pain. The other 5% are actually paid by the Department of Fishing and Fishery and Wildlife, and so they really have a stake in the opposite conclusion. So if fish feel pain, then what about other creatures? Now, it turns out, I think, cephalopods, that is, squids and octopuses, do also possess sentience. Crustaceans, probably not, and insects, probably not, although bees, it's disputed. And so basically, I think we should be open to the results of scientific research. And I love to tell people in the book about the new scientific research because I think it's so wonderful what people have done. But basically, once we know that a creature actually is sentient, then it would move to the other side of my line. I think the best way to show sentience is twofold. First of all, look at anatomy. Does it have the kind of organs that could give a sensation of pain? Second, explanation of behavior. Is there behavior that can be best explained or explained in no other way but by ascribing sentience? And for plants, that just fails. So anyway, that's where I draw the line. And I don't mean that we shouldn't care about plants. I think there are ethical reasons to care about plants and the other parts of the natural environment, and insects too. Instrumental reasons, because they help support the lives of humans and other animals, but also reasons of intrinsic value, but not reasons of justice, because justice really involves the idea that a creature who has a point of view on the world, who perceives something, who goes to get it, is thwarted. And that, I think, doesn't apply to plants.
Just on this regard, before I ask another question, as you know from having lunch with me a lot, I'm a vegetarian, but some years ago I started eating fish and on occasion, and someone asked me, and I said, well, because they don't scream very loud. But your book seems to show, that fish, in fact, do feel pain, and so I should probably revisit my view.
Okay, now wait a minute. So there's a separate issue, which is, when is death a harm to a creature, and how is it a harm? And, you know, Epicurus, for example, thought death was never a harm, because when you're gone, you're gone, and you don't mind being gone. And so long as the death is painless, then it isn't a harm to you. Now, in earlier work on the Greeks, I actually differed with Epicurus, and I said, no, but the harm of death is that when you have projects that extend over time and are heading to a conclusion, and you're blocked in the middle, then death is a harm because it thwarts retrospectively the life that you were leading. So suppose you wanted to be a lawyer and you spend all your time preparing for the LSAT and then you die. Well, that kind of makes your activity of preparing for the LSAT sort of meaningless and thwarted. So that's the kind of argument I develop. Now, that means that animals can be harmed by death, not all animals, but only those who have projects that extend over time. So while I do think that fish feel pain, and therefore any death would have to be painless, I do think that fish do not have the kind of projects that extend over time. They live in the moment, and therefore I do tentatively say, and I eat fish too, that the painless, truly painless death of a fish, and there are humane fisheries that conk the fish with a mallet rather than pulling it up with a line, which is very painful, of course, that if the fish has enough time to live, swim around for a while, and then is killed truly painlessly, then that's okay. But I'm very tentative about that. I feel a little bit guilty about this, and we ought to still explore alternatives and so on, but that's where I am right now.
So, listening to Martha talk first about what is the justification for even thinking about granting rights was really interesting. But there is some line drawing. And I guess I'm curious if you took away the same thing from the interview as I did, which is that Martha is really drawing the line using what I think is a pretty common argument, which is whether or not the entity feels pain. She sort of drew a distinction between plants and animals, right? And the fact that fish actually, that there's research that demonstrates that fish feel pain, which I know was really bad news for you, but hopefully you still are going to be able to reconcile it with your eating habits. But the basis, the justification for thinking about whether or not rights, animals have rights, is this issue of pain. Is that also what you understood?
Yeah. The feeling of pain. Now, to be fair, I think, one could extend, I don't think one would draw a sharp line between all animals that feel pain and, for example, trees. We know that trees communicate with each other, that they are in relationship with each other, obviously feel some sort of pain. They're not sentient beings, but there's something there. So, yeah, I sort of wonder about that line. For myself, I eat only small fish now, like sardines and stuff. And that's probably hypocritical because, if sardines feel pain, I don't know that it's for me the line. I had rather liked her idea that, these are the creatures that are trying to exercise their capabilities, have a right to do so in a natural way. And we humans have to accommodate that. And so, small fish get to swim around in the ocean and then, they're going to get eaten either by a bigger fish or by a human. Okay. Their life projects weren't destroyed. But an animal in a zoo, you know, especially a large animal, she says, well, you know, that really is completely interfering with their way of life, if I can use the term. And so that struck me as a really intuitive and interesting basis on which to make these judgments. Early in your book, you actually seem to imply that, you know, okay, let's say if I could live my life completely free of, you know, eating animals or anything like that directly, I'm still not really off the hook, right? Because there's other ways in which human activity harms animals.
Oh, yes. We're all on the hook. Let's take land. All of the habitats of big land animals are controlled by human beings. And some of those habitats have been damaged by climate change, which, of course, is human-caused. Others have been damaged by sheer overpopulation. If you think about elephants in Africa, they need to strip the bark off of trees. The villagers hate having those trees stripped because they need them to live. And there's constant conflict between elephants and villagers. And the reason is, of course, that there is human overpopulation. And the land that the elephants used to wander freely has been taken over by people. There's also poaching and all kinds of ways in which crime defaces the life of large animals. In the seas, there are two kinds of problems that marine mammals have. The first is sound pollution. Marine mammals negotiate their world by sound, much more than by smell or hearing, which are weak. Coastally, we've been able to regulate that. The U.S. Navy sonar program was declared illegal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act because of the way in which that noise disrupts the life activities of marine mammals. And the judges were great because they gave a whole list. It inflicts stress because you can measure stress hormones in whales. It makes whales delay reproduction, delay migration, migrating with reduced energy reserves, and so on. But when we get into the deep seas, there's absolutely no way of regulating right now. So the oil companies are out there drilling, trying to find undersea oil. And what they first do before they even can drill is they try to make a map of the ocean floor. They send what are called air bombs down to the floor to try to chart it. Well, of course, that makes a din all over the ocean. And whales are troubled by that. And we've measured stress hormones in whales, and we know how much they've gone up. Then there's plastic trash. Every time we use a piece of disposable plastic, it almost always ends up in the ocean. Now, whales eat that plastic because it looks appealing and it gives them a sensation of fullness. So there are whales that have been washed up dead, and they open them up and they find 88 pounds of plastic trash, all these single-use items like, well, bottles, but also flip-flops even. So that is a terrible cause of death for whales. And, you know, we're all on the hook about that. So we all have to pay attention to getting rid of single-use plastic and to supporting cleanup efforts for the plastic that's already out there.
Let me go back to something I probably should have started with, which is your capabilities approach. As you acknowledge, you're not the first philosopher to tackle the problem of animals, but you do have this distinct angle on it. And so I wonder if you can just briefly lay out how the capabilities approach, which we've talked about, of course, in an earlier episode, why you think it's applicable to animals. Why do you think there's a better framework?
So what the capabilities approach is, we should ask the question, what are people actually able to do and to be? And capabilities are spaces within which people are able to choose what they value. So why shouldn't animals have the same theory? What opportunities do they have to choose to live and act in the various ways that are characteristic of their species? Just as with humans, you're not going to look at a single thing, you're going to look at lots of different things, life, health, bodily integrity, community, and so on. So with animals, we need a list that identifies the central activities in each animal's life and asks how well it's doing in access to those characteristic activities. Animals who are treated pretty well and don't feel pain might still be deprived of freedom to move around over a large space, deprived of the company of other creatures of their kind, and they might not miss it because they've never known it. But there's another theory around there in the animal world that I also wanted to dispute, and that is the theory used in litigation quite often by the Non-Human Rights Project and Stephen Wise. I call it the so-like-us approach because Stephen Wise imagines nature as a ladder, the traditional image of a scala naturae, a ladder of nature, and humans are at the top. Some animals are close enough, high enough on the ladder, that they could kind of squeak in the door, and we should treat them as persons in law. So he's brought cases involving great apes and an elephant recently, saying that they should be treated as persons in law. And so, what are the problems with that approach? Well, first, it just does nothing for the vast majority of animals who are being tortured in the factory farm industry. And he thinks, well, but this is what judges are ready to do right now. We should do this and then worry about the rest later. But I think that's wrong. If you get people hooked on a theory, then they're going to stick with that and they're not going to expand their consciousness. But the second problem is that it's just wrong about nature. Nature is not a series of steps higher and higher and higher. Some animals have abilities that we humans totally lack. Birds can navigate all over the globe by perceiving magnetic fields. That's a sense that humans absolutely lack. Dolphins can tell what's inside an object by their capacity for echolocation, that is, reading an object by the reverberations that come back from the object. One amazing example of this was that a dolphin told her trainer, she signaled to her trainer, that the trainer was pregnant, even though the trainer herself didn't know that, because the dolphin got the fact that there was something new inside and signaled, they had a series of signals between them. She signaled to the trainer, go get a test, and the trainer did, and she was pregnant. So these are abilities we lack, and there are lots of other things to say about this. Birds use complicated languages that have syntax and complicated structure. So in short, they're just abilities that we never knew about. And science in the last 30 years has brought so much of this to light that one of the great pleasures for me of writing the book was just learning all the stuff that's out there. And then there's the Kantian theory of Chris Korsgaard, who, as I say, it's a wonderful book, and I think I agree with it about the foundation of rights. What I differ with is that although she doesn't think that having exalted forms of moral reasoning makes humans better than animals, she disputes that very nicely, she does think that it means that humans are the only ones who can be what she calls active citizens, meaning making laws, but also giving indications that are taken up and made into law. Now, of course, we humans listen to the indications of many humans who don't use language, people with severe cognitive disabilities, whether young or older, but also infants and children. All of those are taken account of. And certainly animals give plenty of indications of what they need and what they want through their forms of vocalism, but also just through the way they try to move and act. So there's absolutely no reason why the preferences of animals shouldn't be as active beings, shouldn't be taken account when laws are made.
You know, Martha made this amazing point about the sort of folly of actually judging animals based on our skills, right? Because animals have all of these other abilities and skills that we don't have. So, you know, I was thinking that's interesting too, because human rights are based on human capacity, human skills, and human priorities. And what you and I are saying right now is, okay, well, we'll give animals a subset of rights because we recognize that they don't have the same skills we have. But what if there's actually a greater obligation, which is to take animals for the skills that they have that we may not have and build rights around those skills, if that makes sense? Because there could be rights that animals could have in relation to each other, right? That just aren't relevant to us, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of underwater drilling, which he was talking about, goes to that.
I mean, there is a part of me that just thinks there are limits. We understand so little about, I think, what animals' internal life actually is, that it just seems to be a lot of hubris for us to be making these assumptions and trying to come up with rules around them. At the same time, you know, obviously we're impacting their lives in a negative manner all the time. And so there is some responsibility there, but I'm just not really sure where it ends.
Well, maybe the study, the science itself is, you know, important. We owe animals a duty to try to understand them as much as we can. I sort of like that because I like anything which supports the acquisition of knowledge, as you know. I think that's, you know, a duty in some sense that humans have. The more we know, maybe would lead to greater protection. I don't know. I mean, there is, I guess, Martha's risk that we give higher protection to the animals that are like us, the chimps and the dolphins, I suppose. But still, I just think more knowledge is going to be helpful.
That leads me to ask you about zoos. How do you think about zoos?
Well, I think the test is, can the animal live a form of life that's reasonably like the form of life that species would live without the confinement? Sometimes the answer is yes. I think a lot of fish can live pretty well in a decent aquarium. Sometimes apes, if the colony is large enough and humans are kept at a distance. But most zoos, of course, deprive creatures of their normal form of life. Elephants need to wander over 200 miles a day. So I think elephants should never be kept in zoos. Dolphins, again, they are usually very communal, maybe 30, 40 dolphins in a pod. No theme marine park keeps them that way. Now, the problem is not only that they don't get to live their life, but they don't even get to learn their life. Until recently, I think most scientists thought that behavior of animals is all genetic. Now we know that that's not true. Most of their behavior, of these large species I'm talking about, is learned socially. And so if you kidnap an orca from its pod and you put it down in a marine park, which is what happened in the movie Blackfish, you know, Tilikum, the one who in the end behaved in a crazy way and killed his trainer, that was one who'd been kidnapped as a baby, and therefore he never learned the rules of orca behavior. So I think zoos are not the only places, luckily, that children can learn about animal behavior and learn empathy. We have so many great films now, but just looking at also picture books, you know, I don't think we should get rid of zoos, but we should make sure, as Lincoln Park Zoo has basically gotten rid of the elephants and they've gone over to entirely research purposes where they use apes, but in a very animal-sensitive way, giving them a good form of life. So that's what zoos should be in the future.
I don't know if you saw that the draft of the Chilean constitution, it provided for a state duty to protect animals, recognizing their sentience and their right to live free from mistreatment, which I think may be the first time we've ever talked about animals as having rights in constitutions. There are many mentions about animal husbandry and their, you know, sort of use to humans, but this was really kind of a conceptual jump.
Well, no, the Indian constitution, now animals through courts have been recognized as persons under Article 21 of the Indian Constitution. But, you know, there are other things that other nations have done that I think we could do much more quickly, which is to give animals standing. Right now, so to have standing is to have the ability to go to court as the plaintiff of a legal action. Right now, all humans have standing, including humans with severe cognitive disabilities and young children. Of course, I mean, no one can go to court on their own, or at least they shouldn't. They should get a lawyer anyway. But certainly, people with severe cognitive disabilities need not only a lawyer, but they also need a guardian or a surrogate who represents their interests. So why shouldn't the same thing be true for animals? Well, Cass Sunstein wrote a famous article called Standing for Animals, where he looks at the whole history of this problem. And the problem is that even if we make laws protecting animals, what happens when those laws are not enforced? Who has standing to go to court and report that? Well, the animals don't. So then there is developed this weird concept of the aesthetic injury. You have to show not that you have an ethical injury, but that you have an aesthetic injury by seeing the animals suffer. So that seems to Cass, and it certainly seems to me, a pretty ridiculous way of getting at the problem of animal suffering. And he concludes there's absolutely no constitutional reason why Congress couldn't give animals standing if they wanted to. Four countries have given animals standing: Colombia, Ecuador, Argentina, and then India, as I said. And that means that when Pablo Escobar brought all these lovely hippos to Colombia and they were reproducing like mad and the parliament voted that they should be rounded up and shot, the hippos, represented, of course, by surrogates and then by lawyers, could go to court and challenge that parliamentary decree. And actually, the shooting of the hippos was stopped. Now, right now, a U.S. court has said, and it's a district court in Ohio, they said that U.S. expert witnesses may go to testify in this case involving the hippos. So at least they kind of accepted the fact that hippos have standing in Colombia, and they referred to it. And some people thought, oh, well, it's a little baby step in the direction of giving animals standing in U.S. courts. No, I think what really blocks that, you know, is the factory farming industry. In no other nation does the factory farming industry have such a strangled grip over politics. They're so powerful that they've gotten many states in the U.S. to pass what are called ag gag laws, restricting even reporting on the conditions in the factory farming industry. Those laws have now been challenged one by one, and they've been thrown out in 9 states. So I think giving animals standing is the last thing they want. They'd rather do away with the ag gag laws any day than accept the idea that a cow could go to court as the plaintiff of a legal action. So, you know, it's going to be a long road, but we have to start down that road, I think.
This distinction between, even if you give animals rights, understanding that only humans can be active citizens in this world. And what I took that to mean is, you know, that there's sort of, we reserve a level of agency for humans that we don't even really consider giving animals when we're talking about how we're going to organize the world, organize society, what our rules are going to be. And so there is this kind of, there's a ceiling, I think, on the rights that most people are willing to give animals. And I don't know what to make of that, because it seems a little bit stingy to me from a human perspective. But obviously anything else seems sort of absurd.
Interesting. I mean, I thought where you were going was going to be, well, you know, who speaks for the animals, which is an issue we already confronted.
Well, there's also that. Yeah. But the fact that someone even needs to. Yeah.
Right. But we kind of have resolved that in some of those rights of nature areas where, you know, the river, someone can come into court and speak on behalf of the river, and, you know, guardian ad litem we have for children now who are in the public welfare systems and such. And so we have ways of doing that. There's also always a question of who's going to get to do so. But I heard you saying also that, well, maybe that we want limited rights for animals, not as expansive as humans. So for example, you know, it's never okay to kill another human, but it might be okay to kill another animal. If even from Martha's perspective, because she does not say that her book requires vegetarianism, even from her perspective, if you're in that kind of natural mode of doing so and the animal's living its best life until that point.
I want to say the word pet should go out. It suggests that animals are toys and that we use them for our entertainment. And that is the bad attitude that a lot of so-called owners have. And so ownership and the word pet should go out. And instead, the idea of adoption. So anyway, that should be the way of the future. And then we have to think about the bad behaviors that people get into when they think that animals are just their toys. Most dogs are under-exercised. Dogs need a lot more than 2 walks a day. And then they also need a lot of attention and love. Cats, not so much. Cats are more self-sufficient. But dogs need presence and attention, and they often don't get enough of that. So a lot of dog aggressive behavior comes from just simply not having enough exercise and enough love. Nutrition is another problem, because a lot of dog food is not very good food. But anyway, yeah, so we need to think of all those things. And what I've proposed is that there should be a ministry or office in the city, similar to the Department of Child and Family Services, you and I are both mandatory reporters if we see any young children being abused, because our campus has some programs involving young children. So we have to take this demanding 2-hour course about child abuse, and then we have to be mandatory reporters. So if I see a little girl on our campus outside without a coat, I'm supposed to call DCFS. Now, of course, DCFS is a notoriously imperfect institution, so creating an agency is not enough. We have to make sure it works. But if there were something like that for animals, where we were all mandatory reporters, that would improve things a lot, because a lot of animals are treated with great neglect and sort of lack of respect by their so-called owners. People carrying their little dog in a handbag as a fashion accessory. All of those things are subtle forms of demeaning and torturous treatment for that dog.
If you're getting a lot out of this podcast, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called Big Brains. Big Brains brings you the engaging stories behind the pioneering research and pivotal breakthroughs reshaping our world. Change how you see the world and keep up with the latest academic thinking with Big Brains, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network.
So this is something that, you know, I think a lot of people actually think about in their regular lives. Americans are big pet owners. And as we learned from Martha, maybe that's not even a term we should be using. I don't think you're a pet owner, Tom.
But you, of course, do have a pet. So how did Oreo like the interview?
Well, I haven't played it for him, but I actually did speak to my 12-year-old about the interview, because she and I actually talked quite a bit about whether or not our dog is happy or stressed or sad. We were away for the holidays, then we left him with a boarder. And I will admit that I felt guilty, you know, just that like I had left a family member and had gone on vacation. I was thinking it would be interesting, this idea of having a ministry for companion animals, you know, some kind of government body that actually is monitoring in some way the way that people treat their pets. I don't know. You know, I mean, on one hand, owners have such freedom and there's, you know, plenty of dogs that are abused as a result. But it also seems like it would, I don't know, be really infringing on our privacy.
Well, that is an issue that she doesn't talk much about, actually, which is, you know, what's the role of the state, the duty of the state? And we do think there are duties of the state. For example, animal cruelty is a crime, which means the state does have, at some level, an obligation to to punish it when it finds it, when it encounters it. You may remember the case of Michael Vick, the very famous quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons, who was arrested and sent to jail for having a dog fighting ring in his house. So, you know, there's some stuff we do at the extremes, but I gather what you're saying is maybe we could do much more. We should have an animal a pet policy or an animal policy department. Right now, we tend to only incorporate the interests of animals in the sense in which they're instrumental to humans, like Department of Agriculture and stuff, FDA.
Yeah. And maybe what we have now is a little bit like what we have for kids. You know, I mean, the state only intervenes when there's some sense that something has gone wrong. But I think it would change the way people relate to their pets or their companion animals if there was more state supervision. I will say that I gave my dog an extra long walk this morning because I was thinking about whether or not I was allowing him to fully fulfill his purpose.
Oreo is a crazy dog.
Well, you know, I will say pet ownership or companion animal ownership, which I'm going to try to slowly switch to because I really like the term. It sort of highlights really the difference also between change circumstances based on an understanding of rights and change circumstances based on values. So what I mean by that is, you know, pets don't have a lot of rights, right, in American society. But if you were to walk in here as an alien, you would think that dogs have quite a bit of power, right? I mean, there's a lot of, especially in certain sections of cities, a lot of things are built around dogs being comfortable. There are dog parks, you know, their owners are picking up after them. There's a huge amount of, you know, there's an enormous market for treats and toys and all kinds of things. I actually, you know, there are many things in my household that are different because we have Oreo. For example, you know, before I invite someone over, I always tell them I have a crazy dog. Like, you know, you have to be comfortable with this dog who's going to be really excited about you. That's a dog that has quite a bit of power, right? I could lock him in a bathroom somewhere and maybe somebody else does that. But we sort of have, I guess my point is we've demonstrated evaluation of dogs in a different way than granting them rights. But their circumstances and I think their ability to exercise their capabilities has been really supported by those values without creating a rights-based system.
That's pretty incredible. It's more than you can say for people.
Right.
And the amount we spend on dogs, I'm sorry to tell you, you know, would be
huge.
Sufficient to solve the homeless problem, I'm sure, in large part. So
Yeah, that's a kind of interesting trade-off we as a society make without ever talking about rights, never using the term rights. And if rights are supposed to be, you know, a claim that a particular kind of interest is justified and has priority over other interests, well, maybe we shouldn't be talking about animal rights. Maybe we should be talking about, you know, a rational use of the overall budget for animals and humans.
Yeah. And somehow we've actually done a lot for dogs without thinking within the context of a rights-based system. And I guess the question is how and why. Like, we've created standards for the way that dogs should be treated. And I think, you know, most people follow those standards, but they haven't come from any claim on the part of the dog or from the dog.
Yeah, you know, just do we need rights, in other words? And here, I do think it's important to have a comparative perspective, because even if dogs do pretty well, if you happen, in other words, if you were a Rawlsian dog and you were, you know, choosing behind a veil of ignorance as to which country you were going to be born in, I think United States would be pretty high up there, probably Scandinavia and some others as well. Mm-hmm. But there are many societies where dogs are treated extremely badly and degraded and such. And so maybe talking about rights in the same way that we talk about international human rights as providing a floor, minimum core set of obligations, maybe it is good in terms of the average dog living on the planet today.
You know, a lot of people crate their dogs. And like, they will crate their dogs for like, you know, 12 hours, you know, like the dog will basically, and this is a legitimate way to have a dog. You put the dog in a crate at 7 a.m. Hopefully you hire a walker to come in the middle of the day, but then you put the dog back in the crate. And there are a lot of, you know, behavioral specialists that say that the dogs feel like safe and are comfortable there. And it's like a womb and they like it there. I just could never, like, the idea of keeping Oreo in a box for 12 hours a day just seems terrible to me. But I think that's also where the human and animals' interests would start colliding, right? Because part of the reason that people put their dogs in crates is because they don't want them to make trouble during the day. They don't want them to go to the bathroom in their house. You know, there's all sorts of things that we do with dogs that are for our convenience. I mean, the fact that a dog doesn't have a choice over when to go to the bathroom, that's pretty big, right? Like, if that was ever imposed on a human, we would be very upset.
I guess, and then that actually leads to questions about, well, exactly how much, you know, room does a dog need during the day? You know, big dog, little dog, it's standard kind of almost administrative state questions about what level of precision you state the societal obligation, who handles them in the case of abuses and things like this. So I don't know, all of this is suggesting that introducing the rights framework and the rights terminology may actually make things a little more complicated than it needs to be. Most of the people who have companion animals, you know, do so because they want to have it. And so they're in the best position to sort of, you know, figure it out, communicate with the animal, if you will, about the animal's interests. Of course, we have some exceptions. And so that's where society steps in. But maybe introducing a broader notion of rights is needlessly complex.
Entitled is a part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network and is produced with the support of Yale and University of Chicago Law Schools. Our show is produced by Matt Hodup and Leah Cisrine. Thanks for listening.